We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovic. Joining me today is Harley Bassman, managing partner at Simplify Asset Management. He's known as the Convexity Maven, and he's also the creator of the MOVE Index and an expert in financial income derivatives. How are you today, Harley?
Well, it's good, man. Thank you.
Great to have you. And, you know, I was prompted to get in touch with you after my last conversation with Luke Groman, and I'll expand on that a little bit later. But maybe we can start by, you know, digging into what the convexity maven means. What does convexity mean to you, and how do you implement it in the way you look at the world?
Well, like I said, it's great to be here, and Luke is a great guy. He has a great story to tell, which just sounds pretty good to me. Let's dispense with the nonsense here. Convexity is very simple, although we like to use X words and Greek letters to go and make things sound hard so we can charge higher fees for things. Convexity is simply a non-linear return. What that means is you have a bet or a game or something where for equal up and down moves, you make a point or lose a point, zero convexity. You make two, you lose one. Positive convexity. You lose three, you make two, negative convexity. So the trick here is this. It's how do you value these bets, or what we tend to call investments, usually. That's the magic. That's why we hired, you know, a ton of physics PhDs, you know, 30 years ago on Wall Street, was going to analyze how to make the bet. So if a bond yield, if a straight linear bond, a treasury, yields 4%, if you have a similar bond, and because of its makeup, it goes up two, down one. All else equal, it's a better investment, a better security, a better bond. That bond's not going to trade at 4%, because if it did, you'd only buy that. But it's got to trade for a lower yield. Should it be 3.25, 3.5, 3.75, some number that we know it's less than four. And similarly, for a bond that yield goes down two and up, down three and up two, that's going to yield more. And we'll talk about mortgage bonds later on. Mortgage bonds are the kind that look like down two, down three, up two, and that's why they yield more. So the question is, how much more should they yield? That's the magic of mortgages.
Right. So on your site, you have a piece kind of summing up how you look at the markets and market participants, and conclude it with the line that says, as my bosses declared at the start of my career, do not take actions that you would be ashamed to have posted on the front page of the New York Times. So why did that advice stick with you so succinctly? And did you see behavior like that from others around you in your career that was a negative example of that?
That's the front page of my website, convexitymaven.com. It's all about character. I mean, we still read the Greek tragedies. We still read Shakespeare, you know, all this stuff 2,000 years later. Why do we keep reading these people? Because they've hit the nail on the head about the great frailty of humanity, which is hubris, ego. And it's always ego that gets you into a pickle. And that's it in a nutshell. And, you know, people who, you know, have good character, do good deeds. Those should be, you know, reasonable things. And if you do something that you're embarrassed to put on the front page of the Times or the Journal, I mean, clearly it's only a bad idea. Don't do it. Mm-hmm. It's just a guidepost. I wouldn't call it a rule, but it was clever at the time.
And this really speaks towards the idea of greed and fear in the markets, right?
Greed and fear are the polar opposites of investing. Although you can be, I'm not sure I'd call greed a great sin. It's just, you know, taking too much risk, which will end poorly. But I wouldn't call you a bad person for losing money. I've lost plenty of money in my career. I think it makes me a bad person. But balancing those two is important, which leads to my other thought about sizing is more important than entry level. I know I'm never going to sell the top or buy the bottom. As a matter of fact, I tend to go and buy the top and sell the bottom if given my druthers. But the key thing to that is recognizing and knowing that that's my proclivity, and then investing accordingly. So I invest enough money so that it'll make a difference if I'm right, but not so much that it'll wipe me out if I'm wrong. And so sizing is really the key. You see a good idea, you know, you're trying to time it, tends to not work out too well. Mm-hmm.
So as I said, I was prompted to get in touch with you after my last discussion with Luke, and he mentioned that at the 150 level of the MOVE index, which is the index that you created, that the Fed has effectively lost control. So can you explain to us what the MOVE index is and what it measures?
I think he misparaphrased me. I wouldn't say the Fed's lost control. Okay. What I was saying is that the MOVE index at that level is more or less unsustainable because of the more or less panic in the market. Mm-hmm. So the MOVE index, it's the VIX for bonds. It's a real number. It's not an index. It's a real number. And so the VIX right now is like 130, which means that over the course of 1 year, 1 year from now, interest rates will be up 130 or down 130 basis points from right here, mm-hmm. 68% of the time, one standard deviation under the bell curve. Real easy. What's more interesting is a year from now, who cares? That's just so far away. Take that number and divide it by 15.9. You can use 16 to cheat. And that is basically the daily volatility. You're de-annualizing it, the square root of 252, number of trading days per year. And if you do that, 130, you get about 8. And so 8 basis points a day for the next month is kind of what the implied volatility of options is looking at going forward. I think 8-9 basis points a day at 150 or almost 10 basis points a day, you can't move 10 bips a day for a long period of time. People just lose their mind. There's too much risk going on. It's too unstable. And investors tend to go and say, at that number, I'm out. I'm going to sell my longs, buy my shorts, I'm going to get flat. So you really can't stay at 150 for very long. The old rule was 80 to 120, supposed to buy 80, sell 120. This got obliterated when the Fed went to QE and zero interest rates. That took the move down to like the low 50s. But usually, you know, you sell 120, 130, you're going to be a hero. The problem is that never happens because at 120, 130, 140, you're under your desk crying for your mommy. So it's a good idea in theory, but it never worked. When you get up to those levels, everyone's out of their minds. Mm-hmm.
So what has the Fed's reaction typically been to reaching that 150 level at times in the past?
You get to 150 when you have this, Fed versus the market kind of bumping heads. And there being great uncertainty in the market. I think one of my slides might show this, where you look at the yield curve. Now, everyone knows that when the yield curve inverts, we're going to get a recession, 12 to 16 months hence. And the curve inverted last year, so recession coming up March, April, May of next year is about kind of right on time. There's the move. So I think if you go to slide 4. You might have it. The curve is massively inverting right now, and especially in forward space, and that's almost an unprecedented level. Who's going two more forward? What? One more. There we go. This is the 2-year rate versus the 30-year rate, mm-hmm. and you can see that I've circled in orange here. When it gets to that level, like kind of slightly negative, we've gone into a recession, basically a year later. Mm-hmm. Look at where we are now. I mean, we've never inverted like this before. And this is the conundrum here is that the bond market is, Thelma and Louise off the cliff saying we're in a recession like right now. Mm-hmm. Yet the stock market seems totally fine with the world. I mean, we're down, but I mean, we're down from a pretty high level. And the conundrum is from basically a year ago, the Fed said, we're not taking rates up until 2023. That was their projection a year ago. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, they're jacking rates up 75 bips a clip, every meeting. This was not expected. And people were not ready for this at all. And they're still not ready for it. And so this is the I'm not going to make a prediction about the world. All I know is that the bond market is greatly unsettled here, and they're not sure what to do about this. I mean, it's rare you see, I mean, you've never seen this before. So that's kind of craziness. I do think we'll be in a recession next March, April, May. I do think that'll happen. That doesn't necessarily mean that the world's going to end. The stock market's going to crash a lot more. Maybe the stock market's already gotten to where it's supposed to go. But the bond market's definitely unsettled here. And that's why the move is so high, is because we just can't figure out what's going to happen. Because usually when it's going to curve this inverted, we hit the recession and the Fed just jams rates back down again to kind of soften the landing. And so that's the uncertainty right here going on.
So when do you expect to see that we will, you know, officially see or officially be in recession, Harley?
You know, one could say we already were in one. We did have two negative quarters of real GDP. Now the Atlanta Fed is looking at a four handle coming out for this next quarter. So I guess that was the shortest one we ever had. I think the Fed is going to go keep this tightening and tightening until they push us into a recession. Is it going to happen next March, April, May, like it kind of supposed to? Maybe, but I think they're going to do that. I think you know, the Fed got themselves into a pickle. They kept rates at zero too long. They kept QE too long. As I've written about in the past, they did this because of politics. Jay Powell was supposed to get renominated last summer. They didn't do it. They dragged their feet. They didn't do it till November. They didn't vote till March. Mm-hmm. He wanted to tighten last summer when we first had CPI clipping to 4 or 5%. He couldn't do it because he was afraid that he would not get renominated. There'd be a dovish Fed person put up instead. Was it a mistake? Well, once again, talking about, you know, hubris and ego, he wanted to stay Fed chairman, so he did that. And then the problem is we stayed too long, and now he's got to go too hard the other way. As usually happens, the Fed tends to break something before things get fixed. I guess one could say Bitcoin got broken, so maybe that was the toy, but usually it's something else. But I think they're going to keep taking rates up slowly. Now instead of 75, it'll be 50s and 25s. Mm-hmm. But they're going to keep cranking it up until they get CPI to a four handle, until they get core PCE to a two handle, and maybe that means they have to get unemployment up to a 4.5, 5. They just got to keep cranking this thing up until they can go and squeeze down the demand side of the equation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
by the way, I will say this. It's going to hurt. It's a public policy good. Hate to say this, it's a public policy good. Mm-hmm. The reason why is this. If you look at the basic quintiles of income in this country, the bottom 20% is 27,000 and below. The top quintile is 141,000 and above. Mm-hmm. They're going to be fine. The guys above and below, government will take care of you down below. You can afford inflation above. It's the 60% in the middle who are getting squeezed by inflation because their jobs don't offer big Wall Street bonuses. Their income moves 2-4% maybe. And therefore, a six handle on inflation, just they have negative income growth, real income growth. That's bad. So 60% of the population is being harmed by this. If we take unemployment from 3.7 to 4.7, yes, that 1% that lose their jobs, that's really, really bad. Call it what, 10 times worse, 15 times worse than, you know, having inflation eat away at your real income? Mm-hmm. Fine, 60% versus 15. I think it's too bad they got here, but they did, and now we got to go and something's got to give. So there's got to be some pain, and I think that's probably the best way to allocate it. I mean, it won't be me. I'm in the top quintile, but I mean, I think as a public policy measure, it's got to be done. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it seems crazy now, just going back to what you were saying about Jay Powell really wanting to be reconfirmed and serve as the head of the Fed. It seems like such a difficult job and position to be in right now. And what do you think that ends up meaning for his legacy? Is he always going to be this bad guy, despite, you know, objectively maybe having this public policy good at the end of the day?
I suspect you hinted we may speak about demographics later on. Let's just go and see what he's looking at. Is he's looking at in the 70s, Arthur Burns was chairman of the Fed. He got beaten up by Nixon and other politicians, and basically the inflation genie kind of popped up during his tenure. He did actually raise rates a few times by quite a bit, but the inflation didn't go away, and people do not have kind thoughts of Arthur Burns. Paul Volcker came in and jammed rates to 20-odd percent, tossed us into two big recessions, basically put the SNL savings and loan business, you know, wiped them out. Mm-hmm. But inflation came down, and it's been down for 40 years since then. He gets the accolades. Is that fair? Maybe, maybe not, but that is the story. And he's looking back saying, well, do I want Arthur Burns on my headstone or do I want Volcker on my tombstone? I think I'll go with Volcker. Good or bad, deserved or not, I kind of like that idea. And thus, there he is. And, mm-hmm. and I think he's going to go and follow that path of taking rates up to squeeze out inflation. My good friend and colleague, Mike Green, will disagree vociferously with this idea. About the reality of the economics of it all. But once again, when you're talking about ego, that doesn't really matter, man. It matters what the paper says on your obituary, and he'd prefer that. Mm-hmm.
So why do you think inflation is unlikely to materially decline before the Fed gets to its target policy rate? Is this due to lagging components in the structure of inflation?
Look, inflation is hard to, it's a lagging indicator. Mm-hmm. And so a big component of inflation is housing, which is measured as OER, owner's equivalent rent. Mm-hmm. And the idea, and the Fed made this change 30, 40 years ago, the reason why is a house is both where you live and an investment. And the idea was to pull out the investment component and just look at the shelter component. And so they ask people, how much could your house rent for? And you basically see the OER follow house prices, like a six-month lag. Mm-hmm. House prices have turned over in the last few months, but you're still going to have this lag of OER behind you. So inflation is going to stay high for a while for that. Goods have rolled over. So your supply side, supply chain problems, they've been cleaned up a lot. So goods have rolled over, but services have not. And I just don't think services are going to roll over that quickly at all. I think they're going to keep on going. I'm not even convinced we can get inflation down to 4. If we get to 4, I don't see 2 for a while. And I say this because, I mean, just walk around. I mean, every shop you see says help wanted. Mm-hmm. The they're all offering above minimum wage. I mean, you go to your friendly hamburger, you know, joint. I mean, they're offering $17, $18 when $15 is minimum in California, just to pull people in. Airlines can't run full airports because they can't get enough staff. I think it's going to take quite a while to pull people in. And then the grand overall scheme is we have this grinding of the gears between the boomers and the millennials. And this is away from the fact that we, the boomers, have stolen the millennials' money via various, you know, tax schemes. Just talking about this pure people, what was going on in the 70s? The 70s was, we have the story that it was LBJ, guns and butter. Mm-hmm. In the 60s and early 70s, where you fought the war in Vietnam and you had the Great Society programs, Medicaid and income support for the poor. And this deficit spending created the inflation, which is true. I mean, that did contribute. But the bigger thing was you had the baby boom population, 1946 to 64, coming of age in the mid to late 70s. All right. This is when they're turning 28 to 32. They get married. They buy a house. They buy a car, a washing machine, a baby carriage. They're demanding all this stuff. Mm-hmm. They're demanding it from the World War II generation, which was smaller, one, because you had a much lower birth rate during the Depression, and number two is, well, they were killed in the war. So you have this pull of demand from the boomers who are reaching their peak spending patterns, demanding it from a smaller population behind them, and that's what drove inflation, and once we peaked over, so if you go, I've written about this quite a bit. In many of my, you go look at my commentaries, I have some great charts there showing the labor force growth rate versus the 10-year treasury rate. And they kind of just follow right in line. It's happening again, man. The boomers are retiring. Average boomer is about 62, 63. So they're kind of hitting that time to retire. Mm-hmm. Stock, bond market, all-time highs. Probably backed off a little bit. Whatever. I mean, where your IRA or 401k is now is much higher than it was 10 years ago, much higher than you ever expected it to be. Why not quit early? COVID pushes you out of work? And why come back? Nonetheless, the millennials, they're getting married. I have four kids. My two daughters, they got married last year. Mm-hmm. The babies are going to come. The houses are going to come. It's all happening. The millennials get married 4 to 7 years later than the prior generations do. First child for millennials is 32 in San Fran, 31 in New York. This was much later than what we used to do in prior generations. So it's a bit of a little mismatch here, but it's lining up with the millennials are having kids when the boomers are retiring. And there you go. So I think you're going to have this sustained demand side for services. What do millennials like? Millennials like experiences. They don't want hard goods, and that and services is, you know, if you get an experience from. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be a mismatch for quite a while, unless you're going to have inflation. It's not going to 8-12%. Don't worry about that. But 4, I think that's pretty easy. And mm-hmm. So what's the question is, what happens to the investment universe if inflation comes down to 4 and just stays at 4? I mean, that's not a crazy high number, but also, I mean, you're not going to have treasuries, 10-year treasuries at 3.5% either, I don't think. So I think that's where we're heading. And we don't know what the Fed's going to do and what we're going to go and do with a constant 4% inflation rate for, you know, 3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's exactly, you know, where my thoughts went is does the Fed have to raise their target inflation rate to 4 to match that? Or are they still going to target, let's say, 2, 2.5?
I think they're going to target 2. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have a dual mandate. One is high employment. Mm-hmm. And 2 is currency stability. I mean, when you have a 4% inflation rate, man, you are devaluing, you know, the U.S. dollar at a fairly fast clip. Even 2% is a pretty fast clip if you look back what things cost, you know, 15, 20 years ago. So I think they're going to have a goal of 4, but they might be content to go and let it slide back there as opposed to jamming it down. So, I mean, are they taking funds to 6%? I don't think so. But they might threaten to do it. But I think they're going to get to, my prediction has been they get to a 460, 470 funds rate. So 2 is at 430, 440 is a fine trade. Mm-hmm. Could they get to a 5 handle? I suppose, Sue, but I don't see it going way higher than that. I think at that level, the brakes have been applied. You just got to let the brakes do their job. There's no reason to crash the car into a wall. Just go a four or five. Funds rate will do its job of slowing things down.
So I want to kind of go back to just make this a bit more explicit. You're one of, I think, probably only the second person I've ever talked to that really points towards demographics being the one of the real factors in bringing inflation down in the 70s and 80s. Rather than just Volcker's reaction to that, like you're talking about, that 20% funds rate. So can you give us the example, let's say, of how the boomer generation created that inflation and then helped curb it, and then what the, you know, using that same idea to combat what we're seeing right now?
I mean, I think, you know, just to kind of reiterate over here, demographics is like a giant iceberg, mm-hmm. where you have 90%, you know, below the water, and the 10% is above, and all mm-hmm. we ever see is what's on top, and the 90% below is where all the action's happening. It's just so slow. You can never actually see it except 20 years later. You can't trade it. I think if you look at the big picture of the life, the entire U.S. has basically been digesting the pig and the python of the baby boom generation. It's just such a massive, massive bulge to compare to what we had prior. Mm-hmm. Now, the millennials actually are numerically greater. There's more millennials than there are boomers. But the percent of boomers at the time, 40, 50 years ago, is so much greater than the percent of millennials now, because the population has doubled or tripled. Mm-hmm. Processing these boomers has been everything. I mean, when I got to New York in the early 80s, you already saw it happening where prices were going up for real estate. And all of a sudden, you saw studios, apartments falling and two-bedroom apartments going up. What was happening? Well, you had two boomers selling their studios or one bedrooms, marrying and buying the two bedrooms so they can go and have a child. Mm-hmm. I'm sure the bicycles have gone through the same process of you know, you stop riding your bike after you get a car to get a job. I think everything has gone through that process. The thing is just too long term. I mean, if you want to talk about the biggest event going forward, don't look at the U.S. I mean, we're going to be fine. There's some grinding of the gears, but we're going to be fine. China is the nightmare scenario. They have 1.3, 1.4 billion people. That population might get cut in half next 50 years. Demographics is so easy to work with because it's baked in the cake. People are born and that's it. I mean, I guess they could die, but you can't be reborn 50 years ago unless you're Benjamin Button. China had a one-child policy for 20 years. Mm-hmm. They can't rebirth that generation. And that one-child policy, whatever it might be, girl or boy, I mean, you've shrunk in the pool of people who get married. And therefore, you're going to have fewer kids. And also, on top of that, you have smaller families as incomes rise. Is that a good or a bad thing? I don't know. Why it happens, once again, you could speculate. I don't care. The result is income up, birth rate goes down. So you have the combination of China becoming a richer country over the last 20, 30 years, as well as this one-child policy. And you just run the numbers, and their population goes from 1.3, 1.4 down to 7,800 in 30, 40, 50 years. Mm-hmm. How the hell are they going to go and process this gigantic old-age population supported by a very small productive population? This is a problem, man. Will we live long to see it? I don't know. But that is actually, when you shrink a country by size, I mean, Russia has already gone through this. Russia has had a negative birth rate for 10, 15 years now, which is what they're struggling with. And I suppose why Putin is so just an unhappy camper. It's pretty hard to rebuild the great empire when you've lost, you know, half your population. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what's happening over here. You can't trade it. It's a slow process. And I will tell you that going forward, you have two issues here. One is the grinding of the gears as the boomers retire, the millennials, you know, form families. Mm-hmm. We can resolve that, I think. I think we could do that. Let's remind me to hit on immigration before we leave this topic.
That's one of the things I want to get your thoughts on. The
bigger idea is, how do we process this boomer population as they retire? Mm-hmm. We had Social Security and Medicare, and we paid taxes into it. And we sold this as a story, even in 1936, as it's basically an insurance policy. Put your money in, we invest it, we give it back to you, and there you go. It's forced savings. No, it's not. It's never been forced savings. There's no lockbox of money. It's pay as you go. Mm-hmm. When it started, you had the average age of retirement. You had 65-year-old when you got Social Security, but the average lifespan was 62. No one got this thing. And you had seven workers for every retiree. Now you're down to the high twos, low threes of workers to retirees. People are living to age, 82, 81, 83? And you're retiring at 65? Like, this is an entire mismatch. People mm-hmm. are living 20 years longer with fewer guys to support it. There's been lots of great charts showing this going forward, what's going to happen over here. What's going to happen? Look, they're going to means test Social Security and Medicare. What's going to happen? If you make over X dollars, you don't get it. That's what has to happen. But away from that, I mean, processing the boomers in the next 20 years is going to be the greatest challenge we have going forward economically. Mm-hmm. So I'll circle back to immigration which basically
maybe before you get to that, I was listening to another podcast the other day, Words and Numbers, about populations, and they were making that same point, but they used Japan as an example as well, and their birth rate has actually, or their population has actually declined over the last, I can't remember, it was like the last 5-10 years now. And you know, in some ways that could explain why they hadn't gotten the inflation that you would think that they should have gotten, considering how they have treated their bond and the yen market, right?
I wrote about this a decade ago. You can go find that in my library. I write about the Japanese yen trade, some great charts and graphs about the population of Japan and projections going forward. Yes, Japan has been as a shrinking country, which is true. And they've borrowed huge money, which is true also. But Japan's a little different. Mm-hmm. They don't have immigration there. They are very unwoke. I mean, people do not go there. They don't want them there. A very homogeneous society. Mm-hmm. But there's a difference, though, and that's that they borrow from themselves. The currency is held. So all the government bonds are mostly owned by the Japanese population. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the U.S., much of our bonds are owned by external people. And therefore, it's kind of like in Japan, it's a closed system. So they have not had problems. It's a slow grind down. And the wealth that they built up post-World War II was absolutely gigantic relative to their population. So they're kind of basically, they all retired 20 years ago, conceptually, mm-hmm. and it's been a slow grind down. What's going to happen 20 years from now? I don't know. I guess they can collapse the country. I mean, Japan's interesting to me because they've borrowed, 3x GDP? I mean, they own, almost all the government bonds. They own most. I mean, at some point, the BOJ versus the finance ministry is going to say, you know what, guys, you owe this, you owe that. We're just going to collapse the trade and just write the whole thing off. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I mean, this is why the currency has gone, from 80, 100 up to, 130, 140. But Japan's an interesting anomaly because they owe the money to themselves, whereas we owe the money to other people.
Mm-hmm. So getting back to the point that I think you were going to make about immigration, you see these help wanted signs all over the place in the US. And I heard you make the point about how you view immigration, whether illegal or not, and how that has really, in a lot of ways helped society in general, tax receipts, everything like that. So you see immigration as really a key to replacing some of this population growth that the U.S. has lost, right?
Don't see a replacement, man. That doesn't. That's a loser.
Added to.
There we go. Pull up chart 10 on the slide deck. Okay, so never talk about politics or religion and play company. So with that said, please, trolls, control yourselves. The economy is very simple. Number of people, hours worked, productivity. That's it. Nothing more, nothing less. How many people there are, how long you do it, and how good you are at doing it. That's what's important here. The U.S. has done well, better than Europe, better than Japan or Russia, because our labor force has grown. It's grown because we had, up until recently, a positive growth rate of people. Right? We're doing more than 2.1 kids. But also, we've had immigration to people who come into work. This is an economic good because you're bringing people into the country. Are they paying their fair share? Should we be educating them? Should we be giving them health care? Don't know. But don't say they don't pay taxes, because they do. When they rent the house for cash, right, because they're illegals, then they pay that cash to the landlord, he pays property taxes. When they go to the store to buy goods, they pay sales taxes. So they are contributing to taxes. They're not paying Social Security. I get that part. But in the grand scheme of things, they are increasing our labor force. They're expanding it. And that's, I suppose that's good if you want to expand the economy. Since Trump, 2016, forget Trump, we have had a declining immigration rate. There's lots of reasons away from immigration policy. I'll just say that this is a fact right here, and I don't care why it happened. And therefore, this is an economic bad. It doesn't mean it's public policy bad. It's an economic bad because you have fewer people who are working. And therefore, unless you get more hours, more productivity, the GDP rate of growth will decline. Mm-hmm. It may not go negative, but it will decline. And that's my only point over here, is that if you do believe that we should lock the doors on the border and have very stringent rules for coming in the country, I'm not going to push back on that. I'll just say there's a cost. The cost will be slower economic growth. And for you, that might be a cost benefit that's worthwhile, right? That's okay. That's where the discussion should be, that you're welcome to go and reduce immigration. Appreciate there's going to be a cost to it. And if you can accept that, then I'm good. Mm-hmm. I do think that immigration has been the great value to the U.S. That's how we beat Europe. Europe never had the immigration that we had for a variety of reasons. And therefore, their economy has been as grown much slower than ours. For decades, it's grown much slower because they have not had the labor force growth that we've had in the U.S.
So, Harley, there's another part of demographics that I'd like to touch on with you, and that's really how that ends up affecting, let's say, the housing market. You, reading through your stuff, you don't expect a housing crash like we saw in 08. And that seems to be because the way that market has changed, you know, to be more secure, take on less risk, is obviously a positive. But how do the demographics also affect the mortgage and housing market?
The millennials are getting married now, having kids. They're going to come out of mom's basement. Maybe they'll bring the video game with them. But I mean, they're going to get married. And they're going to go live somewhere else. And they're going to have to buy a house. We've seen a massive increase in the cost to buy a house. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I think that's number 9. Rates have gone from 3 and change to 6 and change. And if you go and assume that you're 60% in the middle, because the guys in the lowest quintile, they ain't buying a house. That's not going to happen. The top, once again, they have some flexibility. This middle, their income is their income, and it doesn't change. If you could afford $2,000 a month for a mortgage, you can buy a house for about a year and a half ago, $500,000. Mm-hmm. When you take rates to 6.5%, all else equal, you're going to put down $50,000. That was 10% of the $500,000 house I was describing. With rates up and your income unchanged, and you want to pay the same money, that house price goes to like $350,000, $375,000. Mm-hmm. So you should see house prices in theory decline by 30%. That's not going to happen. And it's not going to happen because there's not going to be the supply of houses to go push it down. People who in a house with a 3% mortgage, they're not going to move, and they've locked in their payments. They're okay. The first thing you pay is your rent on your house, because you don't want to be on the street. And to get a house nowadays, since Dodd-Frank and the GFC, people need to go and prove they can pay the money back. So their people are better financial conditions. So I don't see the bankruptcies. I don't see the rate movements forcing people to sell. So house prices will decline. They'll decline because the demand is not going to be there. I mean, there are fewer guys who can afford a house. So house prices will come down for that reason. Maybe they'll come down 15%. I don't see a crash. Mm-hmm. But what you're asking about is more important, is that when you see rates go up for houses, and people want to go buy a house, and they might say, fine, I'll go from $2,000 a month to $2,500 a month. Take them a little bit over there to go in and afford the house. But their income hasn't changed. The money comes from somewhere. Where is it going to come from? Other spending. So they'll buy fewer of other goods. And that's how you get the recession. they'll still buy the house, but they'll buy less of other stuff. And that will slow, so that's how the economy slows down. The demand for other goods and services slows down because the money's being diverted from house, from spending, discretionary spending, to house spending. Mm-hmm. The Fed does not want to cause a housing crisis. They just want to go slow the economy down by slowing the demand side of the equation. And this is how they're doing it.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the other points that you make is that you really think that it's time to maybe buy mortgage-backed securities. So why is that? And is that, you know, something that you're keeping an eye on, or is it, yeah, I guess just explain why that is, Harley.
Okay. Slide 7.
Okay.
Okay. Mortgage bonds are pretty easy. Fannie and Freddie and Ginnie securities have no credit risk. They're not going to default. That'll never happen. So all you have with a mortgage bond is you don't know how long you're going to own it for. Because if I buy a mortgage bond, it's backed by loans, and the homeowner at any time can refinance. He can pay his loan off and take out a new loan. If I have bought this bond, which is full of these loans, if it gets refinanced, that loan goes out of the bond and I get back $100, my par. Mm-hmm. So what you have is a timing issue. You can get your money back, you know, in two or three years, you can get it back in 7 or 8, 12 years. You're short the option to the homeowner who's long the option to refinance whenever he wants for free. And no penalties involved. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, and this chart here is showing basically the spread, the yield spread of a mortgage bond over a 10-year bond, a 10-year treasury bond. It's about 75 basis points, 0.75%. That's been the more or less the value of that option. So if you could own a 10-year at 4, you own a mortgage bond at 4.75. You could see that in times of great stress during the GFC and during COVID, these spreads blew out. It blew out 3 or 4 months ago to a level higher than COVID and almost as high as the GFC. For reasons, you can read my commentary. It's on my website to describe why. Mm-hmm. All I'm doing here is basically buying a quasi-treasury and selling a call option against it. And I'm now selling it for 1.8%. Now I'm selling it for 1.5% over treasuries. I'm selling an option at a pretty fancy price. Mm-hmm. I'll do that trade. I'm not taking credit risk. There's no default risk, no junk bonds here. I'm just taking a timing risk and no bad bonds, just bad prices. If the forever number is 75 and I'm getting it at 150, what's wrong with that? That's it. Don't put all your money there. But if I owned treasuries or investment grade corporates, I would certainly sell some of those and buy some of these. Mm-hmm. And what you're seeing right now is exactly that. The very big, massive money managers out there, you know who they are slowly selling off some treasuries and selling off Apple and Microsoft and Google, AAA bonds that have very small spreads over treasuries and moving into mortgage securities, mm-hmm. which is highly rational.
So what's the difference between an MBS and a REIT? And okay. is there you know, more risk associated with one or the other?
Oh, yeah, a lot more risk. Okay. A regular mortgage bond, I will tell you, most of you can't buy them. There's a couple of ETFs out there that only buy mortgage securities, but for various reasons, mortgage bonds are very, very difficult to buy for retail investors. So another way is doing a REIT. Now, a REIT is a little different. A REIT, and we're talking the standard boilerplate mortgage REITs where they buy mortgage securities, and then they hedge the risk out. They usually get levered 6, 7, 8, 10 to 1. So they have $100 from you that you give them. They'll then buy $700 of mortgage bonds. Mm-hmm. So if you're 100, and they'll borrow 6 more. So they'll sell futures or other instruments to hedge out the interest rate risk, and they'll buy some options back to go hedge out the convexity. Because remember, I said it's down 3, up 2. Mm-hmm. whereas the Treasury's up one, down one. So to hedge out that disconnect, they'll buy some optionality. The reason why mortgage REITs have been annihilated from where they were a year ago is twofold. One, the spread went from 70, actually went from 40, but 75 to 175. That's a risk they can't hedge. Mm-hmm. And so that cost them basically 30, 40%. The other was that they borrow money. Remember they borrow the $6? Well, they weren't borrowing it at 25 cents, at 0.25%, the Fed funds rate, right? Well, now they're borrowing the money at 4. So it costs a lot more money to go to borrow it. And that's cost them also. So mortgage REITs, they've been crushed because, I mean, not because they're bad people. It's just that was the trade. I mean, we always knew that was the risk, that the spreads could widen or the financing rate could go up. Well, both happened at the same time and have pushed them down. I love these REITs right now because I think the front end, the borrow cost is not going to go to 5 to 6%. I think it's going to get to 4.5, 4.75. So I've kind of seen the high on that. And I'm buying the underlying asset at 150 over the 10-year and as long-term number 75. So I'm levered 7 to 1 on a trade that I think will go from 150 to 175 to 75. And I think my cost of financing it has been reduced. There is risk, I will tell you. If things go haywire, if the Fed was to start selling mortgage bonds, now right now they've gone from QEing, where they're buying treasuries and mortgages every month, to not doing anything, to now they're letting it run off. They're letting the bonds mature at, I think, a pace of about $90 billion a month as these things bleed off. Mm-hmm. What that means is as the bonds mature and the Fed gets back and the money comes back, they don't reinvest it. They just let it go away. If they wanted to, if they felt that they weren't hitting the brakes hard enough, they could actually start to sell mortgage bonds and treasury bonds. They could call up Goldman Sachs or Bank of America and say, hey, guys, bid $5 billion Fannie 2s. That happened, I can assure you, we'd probably be at 200 over. I don't think that will ever happen. I think the Fed will let this stuff just bleed off. At $90 billion a month, we're doing a fine job of reducing the balance sheet. The balance sheet is going to come down by $1 trillion this year. So they'll do that. But that is a risk. The other is that the Fed takes rates to 6%. That also would just jam these REITs on down because then their borrowing cost goes from 4 to 6. That'd be bad. But as I said, I'm willing to make the businessman's risk that we've reached the high level on this. The Eurodollar market is already pricing in a 4.75, 5% funds rate. So the market's already priced this in. Since I wrote about this commentary last month, you've already seen these mortgage REITs jump by 15% from where they were. It's not done. You missed the bottom. It's not done yet. If I'm right, these things are going to come back a lot more. And we'll see how smart I am in December, because the mortgage spread has gone from 177 to 146. That should be about 17 to 20% increase in their tangible net asset value, theoretically, on a 7-to-1 ratio. So we'll see when they release the numbers in January. And if they keep tightening in further, then that book value will go up a lot more.
So, you know, we've talked about a lot of different ideas here, Harley, and basically everything always is or seems to be contingent on the Fed. What do you think the possibility of a soft landing is right now, and what do you think is going to break first?
I didn't have high hopes for a soft landing 3, 4, 5 months ago. I wrote about this, I guess, 2 months ago in a piece called Crash Test Dummies. I love that title, man. I'm starting to think that maybe a soft landing is more likely. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm saying I thought if the odds of it were 5-10%, maybe the odds are 20-30% now. We just got a great number today. I know this will be shown later, but we got employment today. We're just cooking along, man. I mean, we have added a lot of jobs. We have inflation still. Hourly hours worked and is going up. Maybe the economy can go and tolerate this inflation and the Fed's raising rate more than we think. And maybe it has to do with the millennials you know, they're coming to the workforce and being more productive. And maybe they'll soften things out. And maybe the Fed's going to stop right here at, or go a little higher to 5% slowly, and they'll hang right there. And we'll get a soft landing. It won't be a crash. The stock market definitely is not looking at crash. Mm-hmm. The bond market is saying that something bad's going to happen, but you know, it doesn't have to be a crash. I mean, the chart that everyone loves has been the move versus the VIX. Very popular. Now, by the way, they do tend to go up and down together. Please never, ever, ever trade those two, one versus the other. There is very long lead time trading on those two. But the move got to 150, 160, and the VIX, I mean, it's gone over 30, what, three or four times in this cycle? It has been a slow, slow grind on down. Down what? What was the bottom? 22, 23% at the lows? Mm-hmm. It was a slow grind down, man. Is that a crash? Not really. A crash is when you go a lot quickly. Mm-hmm. And so the VIX and the move basically reflect what's been happening in reality, which is we've had very big, sharp moves in interest rates. We've had 16, 20 basis point days in rates. The stock market really has never done that. It's been a slow grind down. And maybe, you know, we've pulled back to where we're supposed to be. I mean, I'm not saying that we won't get a hard recession that pulls equity prices down, but the stock market right now is not voting that way.
So Harley, I would be remiss to not ask you about your thoughts on gold. You know, when I first got a hold of you, you said, you know, I'm not a gold bug, you know, not notwithstanding, I'll share my thoughts with you. But how do you see the role of gold maybe as an alternate currency and within your portfolio, if you think there is a place for that?
I own gold. I'm 5-10% in gold. And gold is not a investment per se. It's an alternate currency, like the yen or the euro. It's just not paper. It's, you know, a rock, shiny rock. The thing is that it exists by itself. You can't make that much more of it. I mean, all the gold in the world would fit into a giant swimming pool or something like that. Mm-hmm. And you can't copy it. I mean, it works as a currency in many respects. And I kind of view gold as being like a giant disaster insurance policy. It's supposed to follow real interest rates. Yeah, sure. It's supposed to follow inflation. Yeah, sure. An ounce of gold is supposed to buy a fine man's suit. That's probably not right. You go to Saks and look at a suit there. It probably costs $1,500 to $2,000 for a fine suit. Okay, so it's all worked out since a Romans bought a toga or suit of armor. Mm-hmm. I say there's a place there as if something really goes haywire, it will do fine. It's a 20-year ticket. And that's it. And I think over 20 years, it will relatively hold value. It can go down or up a lot over that time. But I think it's supposed to be diversified, and I'm fine owning it. But the idea of, you know, come buy gold now before the great inflation is absurd. Mm-hmm. It's a marketing tool.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, Harley, I think that's a good place to wrap up today's conversation, unless you have anything else you'd like to add or talk about.
The one other point that we didn't hit on was the correlation of stocks to bonds.
Okay.
And I've written about this extensively. Mm-hmm. That basically for 20 years, your 60-40 portfolio was to own, well, stocks and bonds, because they went in opposite directions. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so they hedged each other. And that's what you've seen for since the about two year 2000. Prior to that, they went rather randomly, stocks and bonds did. And very often they went in the same direction. And what I pointed out, you know, 10 years ago and, you know, last week is that. And this is whatever slide.
I just pulled it up here. Slide five.
Mm-hmm. That when you get rates above 4-ish%, that correlation flips. But if you go to slide six now, what's happened over here is that we've seen the correlation flip. You now see stocks and bonds move together in unison. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with that. 60-40 is still okay. But if you have a levered portfolio, like a risk parity portfolio, then you got a problem. Mm-hmm. And the reason why you're seeing this happen at this level is when you get rates up to this level, it starts to impact the PE, the discount rate of the of equities, and inflation becomes more meaningful. And I think as long as we have rates up at this level, you will see stocks and bonds move together. If you get rates back down to 2, then they're going to start to diverge once again. But right now, you should expect stocks and bonds to move together, which is why we produced the interest rate hedge from my company, which was where the option was struck at, you know, 4% and change. They needed to capture that inflection point of where stocks and bonds move together, and you need, you know, an insurance policy. So I'd say that when you buy interest rate insurance, you're not buying it because you're bearish on rates. Mm-hmm. You're buying because you're bullish and you might be wrong. It's the same reason why you buy car insurance. You're not hoping to crash. You're buying because it's in case you do. Mm-hmm. And so that's my comment on my ETF product.
Excellent. Of course, all of the commentary and you know, pieces that we talked about today are available on your website at convexitymaven.com. And your Twitter handle is also at convexitymaven. Harley, thanks so much for your time and sharing your thoughts with us today.
Thank you so much. Have a good day and happy holidays.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.